Welcome back to the 9 till noon show. Right, let's get to some more of your comments here. By the way, business news coming up a little later on. Chris is going to be in studio with us, that and so much more besides. Greg, I have one question. How did we survive for the last 2,000 years without all this education about sex to do with our well-being? And don't tell me about suicide numbers. When I was a child, to hear of suicide in the neighbourhood was a once in a many years occurrence. Now, sadly, it's happening every other week, including a good friend's child. It is sad, of course, yes. But I think we're talking about things more. I don't know how we survived. All I know is the most recent study showed that 40% of 18 to 24-year-olds in an extensive survey, 40% of 18 to 24-year-olds says they were abused as a child sexually. Now, that seems almost unbelievable that it could be true, doesn't it? But this is a survey. The amount of... We're seeing record levels of children contacting phone lines and support services because of sexual abuse. We've never seen a higher rate of peer-on-peer sexual abuse. So this is 14-year-olds abusing 14-year-olds or 15-year-olds acting inappropriate to 13-year-olds. So there is an epidemic of it out there. Now, is educating people what's right and wrong? How you can say yes or no as a child? Is that harmful? Well, if we don't do that... How do we educate kids to protect themselves so that they can find best avoid finding themselves in those situations? Because you can't ignore one, I don't think. You can't ignore one. Exactly, Greg. Knowledge is power. Only those who want children abused would fight arming them with the knowledge and language to be able to tell responsible adults. Another, Greg, can parents stop their children from these new classes that learn about homosexuality or bisexuality? I didn't hear this before the election. The majority of the population are being hoodwinked again because the parties would not be in power. What's the real agenda here? Well, unfortunately, every matter, be it how we educate our children, what medicines are good or bad for us, are now political. This wouldn't have been an election issue. This is a curriculum that was devised over the course of the last 8 years in consultation with teachers, with students. There was some consultation with parents. It overlaps two election cycles, so it's got nothing to do with elections. If you don't want your child being talked about homosexuality or bisexuality, you talk to your principal, ring the principal, and say, I see in this new curriculum that we are going to be talking about these issues. I don't want my child present for those classes. What accommodation can you make for them? Because I'm not keeping them out of school, right? So you need to make an accommodation for them. And advocate for yourself and for your children. If that's what you believe, if that's what you believe is the right thing. Now, it's very likely that your children are very familiar with homosexuality and bisexuality. They might have an uncle or an aunt or a neighbour or someone, or they might watch TV shows. They might be watching EastEnders, Coronation Street, any of the shows on Netflix. All of these relationships are there and present as normal, right? So I would be astonished if your children going into fifth and sixth class were not A, knowledgeable about this, B, you know, not necessarily... anti it, right? And C, actually, very confident in who they are themselves. But as I say, all kids are different. You're the parent. If you have an issue, contact the principal. I never said a child would turn gay because of its being discussed. I'm simply trying to point out that the subject is too confusing for primary school children and not something they should be exposed to at this young age. I can only talk to the 12, 13, 14-year-olds. I don't clearly, obviously, talk about these things to them because that would be inappropriate. But you do get a sense in conversation and what you can pick up that they're very aware of what's going on in the world. A caller believes the politicians don't want Maria Steen to enter the presidential race as she'll destroy them in any debate as she did to Micheál Martin in the Carers referendum. Without a Conservative voice in this election, the debates will be bland and boring and extremely unfair and actually anti-choice and anti-equality. Well, we're keeping an eye on her chances of getting on the ballot. I agree with you in that I don't think the positions really between the other three candidates are miles and miles apart. That being said, I would anticipate that Maria Steen might tone down some of the language. So if you're expecting her to come out very strong on certain matters, her line will be, and it has been to this point, on certain issues that the people have already spoken and she respects their democratic will. So if you think Maria Steen is going to try undo what's been done as part of the presidential campaign, I think you might be disappointed. I'll watch on and see, but I think you may well be. Well done to the young man, Mark, to explain how every day he faces the dangerous route from his home to town. He's a wheelchair user. I live in the Lismonahan area and can see how difficult it is for pedestrians, parents with buggies and young children trying to avoid, dodge the constant flow of traffic. Greg, I don't agree with much of Maria Steen's views, but I'm horrified at how hard it is for her to go before the people as a presidential candidate. So much for democracy. It's being undermined deliberately by the party whip mechanism. Now is the time to discuss change to the constitution to allow a more democratic way of standing, not one that suits the big political parties. I'm sure it doesn't happen. But at this point, because she probably does present a threat, you wouldn't have sort of political parties trying to influence what independents might do, even maybe with some favourable decisions that might suit their areas. That doesn't happen, does it? We know that happens in the formation of a government, whereby independents or others could be courted to support a government or this, that and that. But that wouldn't happen in a presidential election to block a candidate, would it? Whereby certain people could be courted to try and not give the vote a certain way. As I say, I haven't a clue, but you'd wonder, you'd hope it doesn't happen. As a Conservative voter says this listener, I'd love to see Maria Steen get the two extra votes she needs to stand. I think it's so important that the country is allowed choice and not just political parties' rulings. Because, you know, obviously the three candidates in there at the moment are backed by Fine Gael, Fianna Fáil and Sinn Féin, who are not Conservative, really, I don't think, are they? No, right? So Maria Steen would be that... that voice, I would imagine. A caller says, as a retired teacher grandmother now, a lot of what's in the so-called new curriculum needs careful examination by parents. I remember attending meetings about this process when Joe McHugh was Minister for Education. A lot of what was in the mix then was questioned and objected to, but thousands of signed petition were classed as one submission. The present content may have been watered down, but I recommend that all parents check and question the content and method of teaching the programme. I always explain the content of any such lessons to parents before I taught it. Parents do check with Rebecca and the organisation A Parent's Right. Yeah. But also make sure, I think anyone should, and this is not any reference to A Parent's Right, make sure you're actually checking what's in the curriculum. Not necessarily what an INTO video from 4 or 5 years was. Make sure you're armed with the right questions if you're approaching a principal. Principally, that's the way to go forward. You ask, you look at the curriculum.ie. It's all there, the tools for parents, the tools for teachers, and you find out if this information would be beneficial to your child or not. Right, so you might think that, you know, some of this information... You know, you'd prefer if you don't, your child wasn't hearing it, but overall the benefit to your child might make it worth it. Or maybe you want to throw the baby out with the bathwater in one way or other. But just, you know, it's a nuanced area, I think. Now we know exactly who is deciding what should be taught to our children and grandchildren, i.e. an unelected group called LGBT. That's demonstrably untrue. But anyway, that's your view and that's fine. What exactly is the obsession with these people and indoctrinating young children on sex orientation? Sadly, most of the parents are asleep. This began with the flying of multicoloured flags in schools without parents' consent. Now it's being pushed into the curriculum. You can be sure the survey they carried out with a certain type of school. Again, the point I was trying to make to the parent yesterday, if you look at, say, the most recent Pride Week, you're not seeing the major organisations putting flags up in their businesses anymore. A number of Pride events are being cancelled because they can't get the funding to support them. You know, for right or wrong, and I do have sympathy for those who feel they're being sort of ostracised or squeezed out of society, as I would for any demographic of people. I think there's a, in terms of certain movements and influence, there is a turning of the tide there. As I say, you can decide whether that's right or wrong. Hi, Greg. Whatever happened about teaching kids about the nuclear family, the one that creates kids, male and female, instead of this bisexual stuff? We're normalising this gender ideology nonsense. We've lost our way. Well, gender ideology and whether someone's bisexual or not are two different areas. I think people fought long and hard to live their lives as gay people or bisexual people, you know, and then now you're sort of throwing in the TI, etc. in there, which that some would argue is a separate situation, but it's a complicated area I'm not really comfortable being in at all. A caller says, it's because the people who want it removed from schools are bigots and are worried that teaching kids about being gay will make them gay because they lack critical thinking. Yeah, I suppose too. Do we consider if there are a class of 30 kids that maybe four or five of them at that age already know they are, and what impact might it have on them? Or if it's negative towards them, is that worth the greater sacrifice? You know, that's the decision people have to make on these things. I'm a 70-year-old man. I didn't know there was such a thing until I was about 20. I'm not sure what that is. Is that anyway? That would have been relevant at the time. What we were doing. Greg, I feel the folks who are saying we need to return to normality in the times of normality. We had rampant unreported paedophilia, people covering for priests and defending the perpetrators. Look at how Sweden's education system leads to such a high paedophile conviction rate. People need to be informed. Protecting them from learning is the same as protecting a paedophile. It is. It's interesting that the moves, not necessarily in this country, but certainly in the United States anywhere and elsewhere, back to conservatism and the people that it does seem to affect. It seems to be particularly women. You know, in more conservative society, their rights seem to be sort of infringed upon or rolled back. In terms of kids, it's, you know, speak when you're spoken to, stay quiet. You don't need this information. We'll tell you what's right for you. And that seems to be the way it's going in certain countries. Is that the way it's going here? Maybe that's what people want. Now, before the break, wishing Kelly Higgins a big congratulations on being one of the winners of The Traitors from all her family and relatives in Ballybuffet. And Kelly will be on the radio at some point. I don't know if it's going to be this show or one of the other shows. She's tied up today, but you will hear from her on Highland tomorrow, I think. As I say, I'm not sure if it's on this show or another. Just an update on the Maria Steen situation. We've just been speaking off air to those who would be very much involved in her campaign to get on the ballot, and they're at this stage saying, with less than 2 hours to go before the deadline, that it would take a miracle. So we shall watch on with interest there. Right. Sarah Wallett is Movember country manager. Good morning to you, Sarah. How are you getting on?
Good morning. No, I'm great.
Talk to us about Movember before we sort of get into you know, some of the focus for this year. How long has it been about? Where did it come from? Is it part of something international?
It's international. So Movember started in Australia 22 years ago. So we've been around a while, and we've been working in Ireland for about 18 years of that 22. We've had a fantastic history in Ireland. We've raised lots of money. We have about 12,000, 13,000 people across the country who take part in our campaign every year. And this report that we've released is really a groundbreaking piece of work for us, because it's the first time we've really done a spotlight into what the state of men's health is in this country.
And unfortunately, it shows that far too many men are dying unnecessarily from preventable causes.
That's exactly right. So what we're seeing is that 2 in 5 men will die prematurely in Ireland from highly preventable causes. And premature means under 75. And that's very young, really. And we've also, this report goes into great detail around where you live, impacts potentially how long you may live. So men who are living in like less advantaged parts of the country are 150 times more likely to die before the age of 75.
And so whilst we talk about 2 in 5 as an average, in certain areas or within certain demographics, that number actually could be much greater. That gets us to the medium, to gets us to the average.
That's right. So I think what we've seen here is that there is a disparity between different parts of the country and the types of services that you can access as a man, the type of supports that are there for you. Certainly also lifestyle comes into play. So people in rural Ireland have sometimes more risky jobs they have to do. And so that also, and the type of life that you lead can be different. But overall, what we're seeing is that this is a stark picture of men's health. And the thing that we say at Movember all the time is that men's health is not just about men. Men's health has a ripple effect across society in good ways. When men are in good health and they're living well, we see all the positive benefits for families, for employers, for communities. But on the flip side, when men are not well and they are dying too young, we see all the difficult ripple effects. And that's what we're really talking about with this report.
Yeah, of course. So we're talking about early dying, but it doesn't necessarily catch people who end up in very poor health as well, which would add to that statistic and how much they can contribute. You know, a lot of it's that we'll talk about the mental health situation and people dying by suicide. But in terms of, you know, cardiovascular stuff, stuff to do with the respiratory system, a lot of that seems to be, or even going to get your levels checked, you know, your blood tests mm-hmm. after a certain age and what have you. A lot of that, we must be avoiding it. You know, we must be sort of rolling the dice on it. My blood pressure's fine. I feel fine, yeah. even though there's no symptoms to high blood pressure, right? You know, yeah. not sort of tracking, levels within your blood that could indicate problems with the prostate, right? We're obviously not really, many of us, checking that stuff out.
I think what we know is that men are less likely to engage in like preventative measures for their health. So men go to healthcare when they know there's something wrong, but they wait longer. And so what we see is that, I mean, cardiovascular and heart health is interesting because this data shows us and tells us that that men are like 1.5 times more likely to die prematurely from heart disease than women. But the same preventative healthcare measures are out there for both. And we can see that there's just a different engagement with these things. And so there are some amazing programs out there, I must say, around kind of working with men and trying to meet men where they are when it comes to heart health. So you see things like Farmers Have Hearts, which is a great program. And there's lots of things like that. But what we're saying in this report, why we're calling on government to look at this, is that we see great things happening around the country in smaller scales. And if we can make this reach more men and actually scale up to do more work, we're going to save more lives. And that's really our message, is that these are deaths that can be avoided and poor health has an impact. We spoke to carers in this report as well, so particularly informal carers, and most of those people are women. And the impact that a man in poor health has on the people who are caring for him is vast. Mm. So carers say that they have, you know, worse outcomes for their own mental health, their physical health, financial health in some cases. So we really need to think about how can we support men earlier in their health journey to make sure that we're addressing issues earlier. They don't get to crisis point. We see this when it comes to suicide, which is the biggest killer of young men. And how do we get to men earlier so that we don't get to a place where they're going to the GP, and we've spoken to GPs as well, who say that 97% of the GPs that we spoke to said they had a man come through their surgery in the last year talking about suicidal behavior, but only 14% of those GPs felt very confident supporting that man. So the gap is big. And if you worked up the courage to go to the GP and say, I'm struggling with my mental health, and that GP doesn't have the support from the system to be able to support you to be well, that's a problem. Mm. So that's really the message here, is we can do better. And we know that the government can work in partnership with the sector, with us, with all kinds of people who are doing great work, and we can improve this.
Yeah, because, you know, hopefully we might reach a handful of people today. I don't know, that maybe they'll do something. What you're doing, incredibly important. This conversation is very important. But as you can imagine, you know, in your role, but also in my role, constantly talking about it whilst the mental health crisis continues. You know, I referenced on the show yesterday, I'm on anecdotal, you know, 16 to 28 in men, and then seemingly like 40 to 70. There seems to be this something's going on, not exclusively in those age categories. And I feel frustrated, Sarah, is that we're constantly talking about it, but we're not really doing anything about it. Not me and you, but us as a nation. You know, like something similar to what we do with road traffic collisions, yeah. for an example. Trying to think of some sort of innovative way or incentive that guys, when they hit 40 or 45, are almost coerced into going and getting bloods done or a health check or something. I don't know how that might be, right? But something, you know, because whilst we're having this conversation, people are dropping constantly.
Yeah, it is. And that is scary. You know, that is a big, big, scary picture. I think the thing that we're saying with this report is it is a massive problem, but we know that there are things that are working. So if these things are working at, you know, not necessarily even small scale, you look at like men's sheds, which are across the country, and they're doing incredible work. And they really are thinking about how do we reach men in the way that men are going to engage with the system. Mm. So there's no point. We see things like where you look at the early screening programs, for example, bowel cancer screening is a good one example, where that is available to men and women. And there is very low uptake for men typically in early screening programs, but we seem to still take the same model and try and apply it without thinking about, well, why aren't men engaging with this? What can we do differently so we're reaching those men earlier in a better way so we can get them checked quicker, earlier, and have a better impact longer term on their health? So it's from our point of view, there are good things happening. We can see them. We can see good health outcomes in these projects and in these things that are happening on the ground. Let's do more of that, but let's also invest in learning about how we reach these men, because I don't think we know well enough as a nation how we can reach these men.
See, what I think is happening a lot of the time is that if a woman, this is incredibly broad gender strokes, right? But if a woman's feeling lethargic or something, you know, like it seems to be such an easy thing to do, well, I'm going to go and get my bloods done. But for a lot of men, that's effectively shaking hands with their own mortality or something. You know what I mean? I mean, how many women listening to this or whatever the makeup of the relation to the relationship, how many women are sick of hearing the other half complaining about not feeling well or a pain somewhere? And they've said to you, look, I'll book you to the GP. Oh, no, I'll give it a week. We'll sort it. No, it's just this. You know, that happens all the time. I am that soldier. I'll be completely honest with you, right? I'm that person. I don't know what it is. Right. But I'm scared S-less of going and getting stuff checked.
Yeah. And we actually, the GPs that we spoke to us about what is their experience with men once they do come to the GP, right? So they've got to the GP, what happens? And what we learned from the GPs are a few things. One is short appointment times. So for some men, that 15-minute window, getting to the end of the 15 minutes is when they finally tell you what's happening for them. And that's a challenging situation for a GP. We see the cost is sometimes prohibitive for people. They can't afford to go to see the GP, and that's an issue. We see where the GPs just don't necessarily have the support or the sort of the background to be able to understand how to tackle these things with men, different to women, different to children, that there is this very specific way. What we are seeing, which is really hopeful, I think, is that when you look at programs that are specifically tailored to men, where they may not go to the GP and say they're struggling, but they might be in an environment like a men's shed and say, you know, I've been really tired lately and I've really struggled to, my appetite's gone. And it's when we have people working together in those spaces, and they can say, as a community, sort of say, hey, you know what? I was at the GP the other day. You know, it was super easy. I just had some bloods done. This is what happened. It's those types of things, interventions like that, we know work. We know they work. There's evidence to show it. So more of that is what we need to be doing.
I don't want to be negative either, though, but we've got serious gaps in terms of, you know, even if someone presents at the ED with mental health issues, what services are available for them? Horror stories of people being turned away or just leaving after a while because they're sitting there with not the same supports in that hospital that there are in other hospitals, and they're sitting there with people who are physically ill, and that could be their one time that they reach out and there's nothing there for them. GPs, you struggle to get an appointment. You know, if you're suicidal and they say, we can fit you in Wednesday afternoon at 3:30, right? That's no good. And then you get your 15 minutes and you're talking about the biggest conversation you might ever have about your well-being. The services that are available through through agencies, mental health services, CALMS, etc., the services, the supports, they're simply not there. And I don't want to paint this hopeless picture. Everyone has to go out and get help, but you know, even getting physical care, we need to really begin investing heavily in these areas, because I think if we're relying on GPs, we're overstretched, and our general practitioners, right, we're always going to have a problem.
I think the thing that we are looking at is how can we look at earlier interventions so we don't get to a crisis point? And that's, so what is possible so that we're relieving the pressure off of that crisis point health system that is already overloaded, as you said. So from our point of view, like, there's a number of things we can be doing way earlier in men's lives, in different points in their lives. We know that, for example, changes in men's lives, like retirement, like those types of things, have an impact on their mental health. We know this. There's evidence to show that. So what are we doing as a community to support men in these transitional times in their life? Becoming a father is a huge transitional point. All of these things, we know they have an impact on men's health. So there's more we can be doing earlier in the process. We also know that men are there's a lot more that can be done in informal settings. So if we look at, we have a partnership that we run with the GAA, for example. We go into GAA clubs across the country, and we run these mental health fitness programs, which is really aimed not just at the young players. We work with under 14s typically. But we also train the parents and we also train the coaches. So what that does is it says, okay, if you're a 35, 40-year-old guy, you're coaching this GAA team, you maybe didn't have the language to be able to understand how you felt, your teammates felt, or identify those things, but we can help you identify that in these young players, which also has a flip side effect on you, and you know how to have that conversation. So that's really where we're hopeful that there is work that can be done from great partners in the men's health sector, but also from government to say, we can kind of avoid this avalanche if we work well at doing this way earlier in the process.
I think we have a huge role, which I think you may have hinted at, societally, to look out for each other, to converse, to care, not to be siloed, to talk. I know this seems like you talk about the earliest intervention. Well, you know, you can spend 5 or 6 years bottling up a thought or a notion or circular thinking or whatever it might be. But if you were to speak about that or felt that there was someone who could receive that info and talk it through, in many cases, you wouldn't get to the crisis point. So I never underestimate. In fact, I always highlight the fact that we have the power here as well. Movember, so is it about awareness? Is it about fundraising? Is it about this conversation now? Like, how do people get involved in Movember? I got a head start. I don't know what's going on. So tell us what's...
It's all those things. It's all those things. So really, this is a long lead up. We call it the hairy season. So you're right in there. So for us, it's really about, yes, awareness. It's actually creating that moment to have that conversation as well, as you just described. So like, it's giving people the open door with Movember, that you see a guy with a mustache and you know, like, look, this is the chance, even if it's it starts as a joke, to have a serious conversation. And it does work. It does happen. It is about fundraising for men's health. There's a lot of work that can be done, and we invest across the world and in Ireland on amazing programs like that GAA program, as an example. We do a lot of investment in prostate cancer as well. But it's a bit of fun as well. And it is a way to sort of get together as a community and do something fun together and do some good.
Brilliant stuff. Sarah, thanks for so much of your time. I really do appreciate it. There's a website, of course, I imagine, and all the social resources if people want more info. Look after yourself. Thank you. That is Sarah Wallet there, who is Movember country manager, 086 60 25,000. Right, later on, we are going to be chatting to Mike Hearn from Hidden Hearing. He's going to be in studio taking any questions you might have in relation to hearing. So any questions in relation to hearing, it could be a tinnitus or whatever it might be, 086 60 25,000, WhatsApp and text to that number, or give us a call on 07491 25,000. So any questions in relation to your hearing, Mike Hearn from Hidden Hearing. So it could also be options for hearing assistance, hearing aids. You know, there's lots of different options out there now with technology. Blooming AI helping you hear even better. There's a ton of innovation in that area. And some of us, you know, are getting to the point where we might need hearing aids. Maybe we believe there's a stigma attached to them. I don't believe there is, and there shouldn't be. But a lot of people want very discreet. What are the options there, etc.? So get your questions in. I don't want to sort of ask all the questions on your behalf, though. I'll try. 086 60 25,000. A caller says, people underestimate the importance of getting their bloods done every 6 months, especially men of a certain age. Does that woman not know we have no health service in this country? Does she know you live as long as you can and die when you can't help it? And as for mental health, well, there's no mental health services here in Donegal, full stop. She does. She's there trying to make a difference. You know, she's trying to campaign with the government and with the agencies to improve services. That was quite clear in what she had to say. And she's trying to ask lads to, particularly lads, given the time we're talking about, to try and look after their health. You know, you can go into your chemist and get your blood pressure checked. You can check it at home, and you could be walking around, you know, 190 over 110 and not even know it. And next thing you know, pop, you're gone. But if you did check your blood pressure, then you could get a tablet that would regulate it, and you would have a better chance of not going pop and then you're gone. So I understand that your message is real, and some people would agree with what you're saying, but it catastrophizes the issue and then means that people who could get some simple intervention might not, because they don't think it's worthwhile. So go, you know, get your blood pressure checked. If you've got high blood pressure, take a tablet, increase your walking, whatever it might be. But we can't not have conversations like that, because your view of the health service, the mental health services, are is hopeless and helpless. But I know exactly where you're coming from, because we talk about that stuff on the programme all of the time. But we can't discourage people by catastrophizing the entire space of men's health and what supports are there. Just an hour and 18 minutes to the close of nominations in the presidential election, and we're being told by those very active in Maria Steen's campaign that she needs a miracle now. She's too short, and it looks like she's not going to make it. But though, as the person said, miracles do happen. Another person who won't be featuring on the ballot paper is Peter Casey. Peter, good morning to you.
Good morning, Greg. How are you?
I'm doing good. Good to see you. Did your campaign ever really catch fire? We're in a different world now, I think, compared to when you last managed to get a nomination.
Well, I had a few personal challenges this time, Greg. My daughter was getting married 3 days ago in Atlanta. So
congratulations.
It was a fantastic wedding. So a lot of stuff was going on in my life, so it just timing was not good for me this time around.
Yeah, I didn't really hear your name much, and that explains it a bit. You know, life has a way of getting in the way of our ambitions as well. But overall, you know, as I referenced Maria Steen's struggles there in getting onto the ballot paper, it looks very much likely that we're going to have the left, including Sinn Féin, back in Connolly, of course, Fine Gael with their candidate, Fianna Fáil with theirs, and it's going to be, you know, that's pretty much the choice. Do you think that's democratic? Do you think the system needs to change?
You know, it really was just the political parties decided that, you know, it was the who they were going to nominate, as they always do, you know, and it's such a farce, you know. For example, you know, a lot of the county councils had their elections on the same day, you know, their presentations on the same day. So it was impossible for people to physically get to the different meetings. Last time I actually hired a helicopter to fly around, you know. Mm. I mean, it's nonsense that you physically have to be there, especially after COVID. I mean, everybody knows that you know, why should you have to physically be able to be at a county council meeting to present? You know, we lived through COVID. We were able to get by and have virtual presentations and virtual decision making. But the political parties decided that, you know, you had to physically be there to do a presentation.
I know that's about getting on the ballot paper, but, you know, you'll see Jim Gavin, he's all over the place, down at the Plough and left, right and centre. Catherine Connolly's been all over the shop as well. You know, they're putting in the legwork. Is it fair that you could sit in an office somewhere, you know, even maybe in a different country?
Physically, Greg, stop. You physically cannot be in two places at one time, right? You know, I mean, last time I actually hired a helicopter to get around, right? But not everyone can afford to hire helicopters. So, you know, and we've had 7 years to get the councils have been able to make their decisions for the last 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 months. And they left it all to the same day. And you had 12 of the councils and 16 of the councils presenting, asking candidates to be at the same place at the same time.
But that being said, and because maybe the political makeup of the councils, most of the time they opted not to back anyone.
But that's disgraceful. You know, I mean, one of the important, I mean, my whole platform was to give the power back to the county councils. In other words, there's 949 councillors. The president has got 3 unique powers: refer legislation for adjudication, he can decide to refuse to accept the resignation of the Taoiseach, and he can also give a pardon to any person for any crime. And my whole position was I was going to delegate the power of the president to the county councils and say, there you are, you decide, you confidentially vote as to whether I exercise those three unique powers, you know. And I'm quite frankly saddened and depressed by the whole thing. You know, it just, it's such a shambles. I mean, Ireland's going to hell in a handbasket, and our culture's been eroded. You know, we're being overrun by legal migrants from Europe and illegal migrants from Asia and Africa. And by the way, we absolutely need more people in Ireland. You know, as you know, we have a mega crisis in Ireland, in Donegal, and we need people. And Ireland can't afford to accommodate more people. We absolutely can. We had 10 million people in Ireland 200 years ago. And
so what's your point there? You're saying that the country is being overrun, but you're also saying that we need more people and accommodate more people.
We need people that want to put their shoulder to the wheel. We need people who want to contribute, people who are going to work
hard. Most people
come
in here on work visas, though, Peter.
Aye, but we want people who are... In Australia, for example, they have a quota system, but they give you so many points for if you've got the skill sets that we need. And if you're under 30, you get more points, you know. And we need to be selective. We're the best country in the world, and we're not being selective.
That being said, Australia is on the brink with the rise of sort of more right-leaning parties who are on the brink of severely restricting visas.
No, you're talking nonsense, Greg. We're not on the right.
No,
we're just
listen to me.
Listen.
I don't think you heard what I said. I said politically, you talked of the Australian situation. It says politically at the moment, like in most countries, there is a rise in right-leaning policies.
Can I just finish the point, Peter?
I'm saying they are self-described as being conservative or right, but they're looking to further restrict people's ability to go in and work in Australia. That's the only point I was trying to make, and it's fact.
Okay, look, we need to be selective as to who we let into the country. We need to be, we're the best country in the world, and, you know, we need to be selective as to who we let into our country. And, you know, if you disagree with that, then you're wrong, you know.
Yeah.
We absolutely need to be.
But you are very sympathetic to the plight of the Ukrainian people. You're prepared to provide accommodation for them. So obviously you're not grouping them in diluting the culture of the country.
You're mixing up different arguments here. One was, Putin was going to try and take over the control of the world's food supply. Mm-hmm. By, you know, if he'd taken over Ukraine, he wasn't stopping at Ukraine. He was going to go on down to, you know, and try and, free up. He was not stopping at Ukraine. And if Putin had been successful in taking over Ukraine, he would have ended up controlling 60% of the world's wheat mm-hmm. supply. You know, so that was, I just felt so passionate. I actually got on a plane and flew to Warsaw and tried to get into Ukraine to volunteer, and they wouldn't let me in because I was too old. You know, so they
volunteer in what way? Like on the ground or take up arms?
Pardon?
Like, were you going to volunteer sort of?
Absolutely. I got on a plane and flew to Warsaw.
But were you to go on the front line, though?
I would have done anything, you know, whether it be drive an ambulance or whatever, you know, that's how passionate I felt about it.
Okay.
And I just really feel that we couldn't let Putin take over. And my wife wasn't very happy with the idea. You know.
Okay. The bottom line is that, you know, the party seemed to have it sewn up. Even to sort of block the local authority routes. Donegal couldn't muster five people to call a meeting.
Disgraceful.
For Tuesday.
Donegal, I'm so ashamed that councillors in Donegal wouldn't even get together to do it. That's such a disgrace that the councillors in Donegal wouldn't even get together to do a vote, you know, just to... It's embarrassing to be from Donegal, to be honest, you know. But
if I was an elected councillor, I would have been interested in engaging in the democracy process, even if I chose to abstain or voted, you know, to frustrate the process or whatever. But I think I would have been, I think it's a great gift. It's an honour to have that kind of influence. And I think if I was an elected rep, I would have wanted to be a part of that. But maybe there's something political happening that I am ignorant to. But anyway, it's not going to happen.
It's such a shameful disgrace that the councillors in Donegal didn't even get
What now for you then, politically? I mean, obviously you're very frustrated with the presidential process. Is that you finished with elective politics now? Just put your feet up?
Well, you know, my wife said, Greg, she said I should retire for health reasons, you know, because she was going to kill me if I stood. You know, she said she'd make it look like a heart attack, you know.
She sounds serious. Anyway, okay, well, I'm sure she won't. Right, okay, I get the frustration. I understand where you're coming from. Your reaction to the fact that Maria Steen, I'm not even sure where you are at in terms of the commonality or the overlap in what you feel and what she feels about certain things. Your reaction to the fact that she looks like she's going to be one or two short, that she's not going to make it onto the ballot paper, bar a miracle, according to her supporters.
Very disappointed, you know, very disappointed. I would have loved to have seen her get on the ballot. And, you know, it's just, I just don't understand how some of these members of the Oakdrift can't just step aside and put their, you know, show their principles and put their heart out there. And she absolutely should be on the ballot. You know, it's just, it's depressing for Ireland.
All right, go and have a whiskey, Peter, will you?
It's too early.
All right, okay. All right, look after yourself. Take care. Thanks very much, Peter Casey there, who is obviously was seeking to be a presidential candidate. He certainly isn't going to be now, and it looks like it's going to be a three-horse race. It is three, isn't it? Caroline, am I missing anyone? It's three, isn't it? It's Ms. Connolly, Mr. Gavin, and yes, exactly right. Back after these.